May it please the court, Robert Robinson on behalf of the appellant Kevin Andrews. If I may, I'd like to spend a couple minutes reviewing my argument about why the jury instruction from the Superior Court was an incorrect statement of the law, and then I'll move into the to discuss the questions that the court asked after our last oral argument. Under Title 11, Section 4120, Mr. Andrews was required to do two things. Well, first of all, he was a Tier 1 sex offender, which is the lowest registration level there is. He was required to go to the State Bureau of Investigation once a year up in Dover to fill out a form that provided his address and his place of employment and some other personal information. And then secondly, if he ever changed that information, he was required to notify State Bureau of Investigation of that change within 3 days. That's it. Those were the only legal obligations that the General Assembly imposed on Mr. Andrews. Nowhere in Section 4120 does it state that if he spent one night away from his registered address, he would have to let State Bureau of Investigation know, as stated by the trial judge during sentencing. 4120 doesn't say that if he spends three nights somewhere, that is automatically a change of address, as stated by Detective Oliphant during the trial. Further, Section 4120 doesn't say that if a sex offender spends more than one night away from his registered address, that he has to notify State Bureau of Investigation, as stated by the prosecutor in his closing.
Well, Mr. Robinson, your case is that 4120 doesn't define specifically the word residence, right?
That's correct.
And there's a gap. And as I understand your position, the trial judge filled that gap improperly by importing a definition from another statute, which statute was specifically limited to cases that fell under that latter statute's purview.
Correct.
So which was an unwarranted extension.
Yes.
Does that state your position?
That is my position.
Okay, so then the next question is, if the imported definition is an improper definition, what should we conclude is the proper definition under Section 4120?
Well, that was a question that the court asked us to follow up on, and so I'll skip to that section of my argument. Basically, the more you looked at other jurisdictions, the more one had an appreciation for the difficulty in defining what should be a very simple term to define, which is residence. The more you looked at the federal jurisdiction and the other state jurisdictions, it was clear that there were a lot of problems with that. I think that the proper approach at trial should have been to let the jury use its common everyday definition of residence under pursuant to 221 the Delaware Code and use their common sense experience to determine whether or not Mr. Andrews had actually changed his residence. And
well, if someone says and I think your client did say he was living back and forth between these two addresses, so what is his residence when you have that form of admission?
Well, I think the problem, I think, ultimately with this, the problem with this case, when you boil it down, is that we don't have very many facts. That's why last time we spent so many times talking about hypotheticals. There are basically three pertinent facts that were presented at trial by the state. One, that he made the statement that he was back and forth. Well, what does that mean? There was no further investigation by the detective to clarify that statement. I, for example, say I go back and forth to work every day, but that certainly doesn't mean that I live at work or that I maintain a residence. Perhaps he meant he goes back to his residence at Deer Forest Road at night. Perhaps he spends the day at the Church Street address in Bridgeville. We don't know. There wasn't any further clarification of that. The other statement was that he spent more than three nights there, and I think that's pretty clear that that's under the 4120, that does not mean that all of a sudden that becomes a new residence. And then thirdly, you had the observation from the police officer, the Bridgeville officer, who said that he saw several baskets of clothes and some personal property coming out of the Church Street residence. But again, it would have been helpful if the detective had conducted a full investigation to find out, did he have more clothes and possessions at the Deer Forest Road address? you know, what other things did he have at the different addresses that would allow give the jury enough information to make that decision. I think that's the difficulty in this case, and that's why we have to keep referring to hypotheticals, is because it was a very cursory investigation. I think it was clear that the detective made the arrest based on that one admission that he goes back and forth, and then at least on one occasion he spent more than three nights at the Church Street address, and she testified that it was her reading of the code, or actually her misreading of the code, that said that if you spend more than three nights somewhere, then you have to change that address. That's, I think, the problem with this case, and that's why I think it needs to be remanded, because none of these facts that would be relevant to an inquiry about where his residence was and whether or not he changed that residence were presented at trial.
Can we go back to your original point that you hadn't had a chance to finish, which was how was the jury improperly instructed in this case?
They were instructed using a definition from Section 1112, and that provision is very different than 4120. It's a very narrowly defined. It actually creates a separate definition of sexual offender. It applies only in cases where the victim was under the age of 16. It's also very stringent because it prohibits conduct such as loitering that is on a much lesser scale than what was contemplated under 4120 as far as residence.
Okay, but what was the instruction?
Well, the instruction was it used that definition of residence from 1112.
And what is it?
Temporary residence. That was the problem.
A residence equals a temporary residence. That's the definition?
Yes.
So no definition of what residence is. All we know is that it includes permanent ones and temporary ones.
And temporary ones. And my problem was not with the permanent, but it was with the temporary.
Well, didn't he use the phrase temporary place of abode?
He did. Okay. Sorry, I don't have it's in here, but I don't have it directly in front of me.
It was whatever the formulation under that statute, it captured this case.
That's correct. And that statute obviously has a limiting language that says for purposes of this section, these terms are
so your argument is your client was not on notice and that if he temporarily changed his place of abode, he had to go to Dover and notify anyone.
I think if he, well, that gets us into the question of if he went over there for a couple days but intended to return back to his Deer Forest Road address, no, he would not have changed that. Now, if the detective had gone to Deer Forest Road and the resident said, Mr. Andrews used to live here, but we kicked him out, we don't want him back, then he would obviously have to change his residency with State Bureau of Investigation. My position is that just by spending a couple nights at an address other than your registered address doesn't mean that you changed your address for purposes of Section 4120. Now, if the person were on probation,
so your answer to Justice Holland's question is he was not on notice that he would have to report to Dover.
No, he was not. I think if Mr. Andrews conscientiously and carefully read and reread Section 4120 and Section 4121, he would have no idea what conduct was prohibited by 4120 and which conduct was permitted by 4120.
But at least to the extent the police officers thought if you stayed anywhere for 3 days or more, you had to give notification, everyone now agrees that is not the law.
I would agree to that, and I think the state basically agreed to that as well. And I think that, unfortunately, that misunderstanding is what set this ball rolling, which resulted in Mr. Andrews being convicted of a felony failure to register. So, but what was interesting, too, was that it wasn't just the officer. I mean, once that mistake was made, it seemed to snowball. You had the prosecutor arguing that in the closing. You had the judge making some statements at sentencing, which seemed to indicate that it was his understanding of 4120 that if you lay your head at another residence, you have to let, or no, I'm sorry, said that if someone went knocking on your door, they would know where you were that night.
So, and in fact, it's hard to understand how that happened, because even if we look at the statute that was used as the basis for the instruction, it says within 3 days of making a change, you need to notify them, but it has nothing, says nothing at all about 3 days being the benchmark for what a change constitutes.
Right. Right. And that was the problem that we had last time with all the different hypotheticals flying around about vacation and you know, we were talking about what happens if Mr. Andrews spent every night at the Deer Forest Road address, but then spent every day, all day, at the Church Street address. Is that his new residence? Is it not his new residence? And I think because 4120 is so vague that Mr. Andrews should have the benefit of any vagueness with that instead of having the greater burden of Section 1112 imposed upon him.
Well, that brings me back, I guess, to the second issue. And let me phrase it this way. Assume we agree with your primary position, which is that the instruction that was given was legally incorrect. And the case has to be remanded for a new trial. At that new trial, what is the jury going to be instructed? Will they just simply decide on their own using their common sense what residence means? Or is the trial judge, will he be expected to come up with a different definition of residence which is reviewable by us? Or are we, as a matter of first instance, to be instructing the trial judge on that issue?
My initial inclination was that the jury should consider residence without any further definition. Possibly if they had questions about it during deliberations.
This is on a statute that's vague by your own description.
That's correct.
Okay.
But the same could be said for any term using that, whether it's employment or anything else, or what does it mean to change your address. And the state presented actually no evidence at trial that showed that Mr. Andrews, maybe when he changed his address, how long he'd been residing at Church Street, if that was their interpretation of the facts.
That just becomes a battle of dictionaries then, doesn't it?
It does.
Prosecutor says, in my Funkin' Wagnalls, residence is defined as such. And then you say in your Oxford American Dictionary, residence defined as such. And what does the jury do, pull out a Webster?
Well, I think that's the function of the jury, to determine whether or not he met the requirements of registering his residence address. And I think that in my supplemental brief, I was basically forced to admit that the 4120 actually works pretty well. I can tell you on the trial court level, we see a huge volume of these types of cases, and typically the guilt or innocence question is very clear cut. And I think that position is supported by the fact that few, if any, of these registration cases have been appealed to this court. You would expect that with the statute maybe that has been amended and sort of muddled so much over the years that you would see a lot more appeals, but you really haven't, because for the most part it's pretty clear whether or not someone is living in a place or not living in a place.
Didn't work very well in this case.
It did not work very well in this case. But the problem, I think, was that the lack of investigation done by the Delaware State Police and the lack of follow-up. They could have gone to the Deer Forest Road address and asked the people there, has Mr. Andrews lived here? The state could have called his estranged wife to testify about how frequently Mr. Andrews was there. You know, all these things were not done that you would basically expect to see as part of a thorough investigation.
Well, that goes back to the police officer's misunderstanding of the law.
That does.
I mean, she asked the defendant if he stayed there for more than 3 days. He said yes. And she had it in her mind that 3 days was the benchmark, and that was end of the investigation, wasn't it?
That was it. And
what does an investigation and prosecution like this cost the poor Delaware taxpayer?
Well,
for this heinous crime.
Well, I think a few phone calls would have been fairly inexpensive, and I think that would have added a lot of clarity to this particular case.
It's amazing.
And again, there is a high volume of these types of cases, so perhaps the detective just thought, well, this is just another one of those cases that will be resolved pretty easily. But it ended up being a little bit more complicated, I think, after trial.
We have nothing in the legislative history or otherwise that explains why the General Assembly did not adopt the federal definition. I mean, they copied a lot out of the federal law,
right,
but did not adopt the federal definition. the answer is why, or question is why.
I don't know. I looked at all, and obviously there have been a numerous amendments to this statute over the last few years, and I couldn't find any explanation for that. But again, you could see in the reviewing the federal regulations that, you know, the feds had their own difficulty coming up with an appropriate definition. I mean, they actually state in there, I think, that even the term habitually, so they define residence as habitually lives, and then they go on to say habitually lives is not self-explanatory and requires further definition.
Okay. So to the question, what should we, this court, be instructing the trial court as to the meaning of the word residence as it appears in Section 4120, your side has no position on that.
I don't have any position, and I don't think that, looking at the different definitions used in other jurisdictions, most of those are very much more specific, and I don't think that it would be appropriate for this court to basically legislate what that definition would be when that wasn't intended by the General Assembly. So I think that a common sense definition would suffice at trial. But I think once that instruction was given, there was nothing that could be said in closing arguments or any argument that could be presented to the jury that could overcome that statement, temporary place of abode.
No room for judicial interpretation.
I'm sorry, what do you mean by that?
No room for judicial interpretation of the meaning of the word residence, which is vague and undefined.
Well, I think when you look at the other jurisdictions, they talk about 5 days in a calendar year or something like that. I think that that would probably be a little bit too much judicial discretion. And I, quite frankly, there's a huge gray area between a very specific definition and what we have here in Delaware, which is no definition. And I wouldn't want to presume to state where the General Assembly, what the General Assembly intended.
Well, is the next argument going to be that the definition of residence is so vague that the statute's unconstitutional?
Well, not for me. I think that it is a highly problematic statute. I don't think just because of that lack of definition it would necessarily be unconstitutionally vague. So that's my position. I don't try to speak for the rest of the defense bar on this. If there are no further questions, I'll save my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Deputy Attorney General Gregory Smith on behalf of the state. Your Honor, it's the state's position that the instruction that the Superior Court provided regarding residence was an accurate statement of the law, having taken that definition from another section of Title 11 that did relate to sex offenders.
How do you get there when the statute from which the definition was lifted is specifically restricted to case to a subset of cases that's strictly defined in the statute?
Your Honor, as explained in the initial answering brief, that this court has encouraged when to take a statutory definition from another place in that same title of the Delaware Code when it is not defined in the specific section at issue. That's the short answer to that.
But the problem is that this particular statute is limiting. It's self-limiting, and that's an obstacle. And my question is, how do we surmount that obstacle to get to the result that was reached here?
Your Honor, the limitation to which your Honor is referring, we're talking about the limitation in 1112.
Yes.
Okay. Because it says for purposes of this section, is that the limitation?
I think that's what he's referring
okay.
to.
Okay. Yeah. I just wanted to make sure I wasn't misunderstanding. That limitation is not so much as to prevent its use or other places in Title 11.
Well, what does that language mean then?
Clearly it applies to that section.
Because there's a particular type of individual whose conduct that section wants to restrict, correct?
Yes, a certain type of sex offender who is subject to, fair to say, a heightened level of scrutiny.
Wouldn't one argue that if the General Assembly had intended to treat the Tier 1 folks where Mr. Andrews finds himself placed the same way, they would have identified them either in the same section or used the same definition for residence? And by not doing so, they mean the exact opposite of what you're arguing.
I can certainly say it would have made my job today here a lot easier if they had. I don't know that that omission necessarily conveys that this court should ascribe a specific level of thought to omit that from a very lengthy SORNA statute that has been amended more than once. The state understands from the court's questions that is it's certainly not an illogical or improper suggestion if were this court to so limit. However, what we have here is the Superior Court did not find that limitation in 1112 was so severe that it could not be used for 4120. And
well, do you agree that this case started because the investigating officers thought if you stayed somewhere for 3 days, that was a problem, when in fact the statute that applies to this case simply said if you make a change, and within 3 days of making the change, you have to provide notification. And we went from that mistaken factual predicate that 3 days was a trigger for going to make notification as opposed to the standard within which you had to make notification to this person being charged.
That is a fair interpretation, Your Honor, that the detective seemed to read in a specific 3-day bright line, and certainly the state has, and I hope I have not confused the court by saying this, it could be less than 3 days or it could be more than 3 days. The 3 days, and certainly to be more precise, it's 3 business days from the change that the individual must report.
But Mr. Robinson's point is, if the state had taken a proper focus during the investigation, rather than simply having the 3-day mistake being dispositive, and they would have actually found out if a change had been made at all.
Your Honor, the state can see that line of argument, but does
no,
not.
No, it's simply a question. You know, we're here, as the Chief Justice said, this has been protracted litigation. We've had arguments, briefings, supplemental briefings. We've invested a huge amount of time in trying to construe this statute. But it appears that the whole proceeding started because someone thought 3 days was important based on an incorrect assumption. Is that right?
I can see that. Your Honor, I don't want to say that.
Excuse me. Let me be a little bit more blunt about it. Let's assume for the moment that this court determines that the jury instruction was incorrect, and therefore the conviction as it stands now has to be overturned and the matter remanded. Is the state going to prosecute again now that the whole 3-day mistake and the absence of pretty much any other evidence other than the bag of clothes? Is this case going anywhere if we use a new definition?
Your Honor, I honestly have no idea. I did not ask the trial deputy whether, in the event this court reversed, the state would intend to re-prosecute.
Let's assume that the language in 1112 hypothetically did not exist, and the issue was for the jury to apply the commonly accepted meaning of the word resident. Would you agree or disagree that this language, which comes out of the dictionary, a place where one actually lives as distinguished from one's domicile or a place of temporary abode, would be the commonly accepted meaning of that term?
I believe so, Your Honor, yes. Certainly, going back to SORNA, the purpose of that was to produce some uniformity in sex offender registration notification throughout the country. Clearly, while that is one of the goals of the federal statute, just based on some of the sampling that the state provided in the supplemental memo, there are differences among the states. And some states have chosen shorter terms than others. But one of the issues that's come up here in this case is the difference between changing a residence by ending or abandoning a residence and starting anew, having multiple residences, having a temporary place of abode. And the issue in this case, there certainly was a motion for judgment of acquittal. That the sufficiency of the evidence is not what has been presented to this court on appeal. And what was presented on appeal was the jury instruction. So therefore, some of the argument dealing with the sufficiency of the evidence, those were arguments that defense had and did make to the jury, but they're not proper for determination of the propriety of the jury instruction before
this
court.
Well, then let's go back to Justice Jacobs' question. When we have a statute, we have a lot of cases from our court to talk about if the language is unambiguous, you apply the statute. And this statute says, for purposes of this section, then it gives the definition. Why can you use that to interpret another section when the statute specifically says, for purposes of this section, and then you go to somewhere else in the chapter and you say, well, I think we'll use this here too. And the response is, well, no, you can't use that here because it specifically says it's only for the purpose of that other section. What's the legal argument in support of your position that notwithstanding the fact that this definition is specifically limited to one section and that you can rely on it in another section?
Unfortunately, Honor, it's not much more complicated than the taking when there is the absence of this definition in one section, being able to refer to another part of the Delaware Code, in this case in the same title, that does define residence, that reading.
But that's the Chief Justice's point. If the legislature knows there are multiple levels of sex offenders, and they focused on one type of sex offender as causing them particular concern, and then they make a specific limitation for that specific category of offender, how all of a sudden does it apply to everybody else?
Your Honor, I guess the short answer is it does not have to. The Superior Court found that it did here, and it's not inappropriate to have found that it is applicable outside of that one section. Certainly.
Well, that's my question, which is why? If we have unambiguous language that limits us to one section, this is not like a case where we have employer defined somewhere, and the question is somebody an employer in a different context? If the definition of an employer said, for purpose of this section, here's what an employer means, we wouldn't go look at that definition of employer for anything else because it's limited by definition. My question is, what's the legal authority, a case, some hornbook statutory construction, for the proposition that if a definition is limited to a section, you can disregard the limitation?
Your Honor, with that assumption that if it's limited to that section, then that limitation can be disregarded, the state cannot say that I have a site for that proposition to disregard a limitation. The state's position was that the placement in 1112 of application to that section was not as limiting as Mr. Andrews would ask this court to make it. If the court accepts Mr. Andrews' proposition on that issue, that limitation in 1112 prevails, then the state cannot say, well, then therefore it should be read into another section. That's certainly where the court is. I appreciate that, and I'm not trying to do an end run on
that
logical
argument. We're just trying to see what legal authority supports your position, because clearly the trial judge took that definition, notwithstanding the limitation, and applied it to the other section. You opened your statement by saying what the trial judge did was exactly correct. My question to you is, if you're asserting to our court that what the trial judge did is exactly correct, notwithstanding the limitation, please cite a case or a treatise that supports your argument.
Your Honor, I believe what the case that state cited in its answering brief. In Duncan, Your Honor, that's the basis. I apologize for wasting the court's time flipping through my brief. And obviously that cites to giving all terms in the criminal code their commonly accepted meaning, unless they are specifically defined elsewhere. That's clearly, residence has been specifically defined in 1112, and state appreciates Mr. Andrews' position that it's defined and it's limited to being defined there. It's the state's position that it should not be so constrained. And
let's turn for a minute from the statutory interpretation back to Justice Berger's question. And I understand that you can't take a position on whether there would be further prosecution should this case be reversed and remanded, or perhaps not even just reversed outright. But isn't it a fact that Mr. Andrews was leaving that so-called temporary place of abode when he found himself arrested for a felony for failing to disclose that it was his residence?
Yes, Your Honor, he was. He, in fact, the police officer was there to help him move out. Yes.
So he's prosecuted for a felony for failing to register an address where he no longer lives.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Amazing. Monty Python should have this script.
If the court has no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just briefly, I think to summarize, the problem in this case is that if Mr. Andrews had read 4120, he would not have known what he was doing was illegal. And I think that that's the problem with this case. It was basically made illegal because of the jury instruction. Which was the result of probably an improper arrest or maybe an arrest based on insufficient information. And when the state just characterized Mr. Andrews as moving out, I think that's kind of the crux of the case also. He wasn't necessarily moving out. He was taking a couple baskets of clothes and some personal property out of the residence. That, to me, isn't the same thing as moving out. Moving out would imply that he was actually living there. That's exactly what we were disputing at the trial. And as far as Justice Berger's question about whether the state will prosecute again, I can tell you in discussions with the trial prosecutors down in Sussex, I think that they don't like to lose a case, and I think that they would like to have another bite at the apple with this particular case.
Now, the other side, Mr. Smith, has acknowledged that in terms of what is the commonly accepted meaning of residence, he accepted this definition, the place where one actually lives as distinguished from one's domicile or a place of a temporary sojourn, the Merriam-Webster definition. Do you agree with that?
I think that would be a fair interpretation. And actually, I, when you just read that, I think that was it's almost the exact same as the Black's Law Dictionary of residence and domicile. It uses some of that same language. I believe that's all I have. I did just, we commented about the context of the, we had raised this issue in the form of a judgment of acquittal. Before that issue was ruled on, the trial judge adopted the new definition, or the definition from 1112. I somewhat struggled about whether or not I should raise the issue about judgment of acquittal or sufficiency of the evidence on appeal. But I think once the trial judge decided on that definition, the denial of the judgment of acquittal was probably appropriate under that definition, but it was the definition that was incorrect. So I just wanted to comment on that.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.